So our next speaker is by Professor David Hunnigan from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and his title is Determining the Order Parameter Symmetry of Unconventional Superconductors by Josephson Interferometry.
Okay, thank you, John. So we're doing this without red, so that's kind of interesting. Well, first of all, I'm deeply honored to be invited to this very momentous occasion and to tell you a little bit about an experiment, which I think is actually quite a nice application of the Josephson effect to study materials of various types. But first of all, let me thank Brian deeply for discovering this effect. And I think I did maybe what many people did when they got invited to come to this, was I thought about the impact the Josephson effects on my own career. And it is indeed immense. So I... Skin advance.
Is it left and right?
Okay, here we go. So I made a list of all the things I've worked on in my career, which has now been a little bit over 40 years that I've been doing things, and I marked all the ones in blue here that involve the Josephson effect. And you can see it's pretty much everything I've ever done. So although I think I've been involved in this probably actually longer than Brian has, I think the few years I've spent on this is having an enormous impact to many of our careers, and it's been really an important thing for me. I should point out that my first involvement with this was a guy named Jim Garland, who actually spent time here in Cambridge. He took back the slug technology that John Clark had developed, and my first Josephson junction I ever made was actually a slug device, and I used that to do some very nice experiments, and then I've done a number of other things over my career. So I also, I'm very happy to be back here because Cambridge has had a very important role in my life. I spent exactly 1 year here working with John Waldrum on a NATO postdoctoral fellowship. Here's a picture of John and Elizabeth and myself. We didn't wear ties and suits in the lab. This is actually from the David Schoenberg's retirement dinner that happened to happen while I was here. And probably the most depressing thing about this is I'm the only one that really seems to have aged substantially in this picture. This was my lab. This is a picture of the screen room at the time. This was my cryostat, and I did some very nice experiments there. I actually went to the Cavendish yesterday, and I tried to find this room. I did eventually find it. But what I mostly found is every time I thought I knew where I was, I'd turn a corner and there'd be a clean room or an MBE machine or a screen room. And I was, I guess, a little bit depressed that I couldn't find my way around. But more so, I was impressed that Cambridge has continued to become a major force in materials physics and condensed matter physics. So I was very excited about that as well. I also found this picture. This is the low temperature group. I don't quite remember the occasion, but I think it doesn't snow a lot in Cambridge. So when it snowed, we took the cryostat outside and did experiments. I think this was an early attempt to save on cryogens. And I think it was very effective. There I am right here in this picture. So my year in Cambridge was only 1 year, but it was very important in my life. As I said, I was here on a NATO postdoctoral fellowship. It was really my first trip outside the United States, which was the beginning of many international trips. And I learned a lot of things. I learned, for example, about cricket. That wasn't so important, but I spent a lot of time doing it, and I was actually a little bit depressed to see the cricket pitch disappear from behind the Cavendish. One thing that was important, I learned about the Josephson effect and the importance of phase coherence, although I didn't learn it from Brian. I did go to a lecture by you once, but I actually learned it primarily from John Waldrum, and your paper on the Josephson effects continues to be one of my favorite papers and most impactful papers of my career. I learned about current phase relations. I won't have time to talk about those, but I'm using that technique that I learned from you a lot for many experiments. I did a very nice experiment on thermoelectric effects, which I realize now was actually a precursor to the experiments I'm going to tell you about on apparent symmetry. I happened to be here when Neville Mott won the Nobel Prize, and that was actually very exciting. But one thing also I learned happened here is I met John Clark. He came through at Christmas, and that has been the start of a very long collaboration and very long friendship that continues to this time. So in 1 year, a lot of things changed for me in this city. Now, another thing I realized when I was here, superconductivity was much simpler then. In fact, it was so simple, I had actually been advised by many people to get out of the field because it was a solved problem. Pretty much everything we knew about superconductivity at the time was on this slide. John Bardeen, Van Cooper, Bob Schrieffer, the Dutton theory. We knew about Cooper pairing. We knew the understood the ground state. The excitation spectrum was actually rather boring. It was this isotropic energy gap, which we now call S-wave, but all the time there wasn't any reason to label it in that way. And the entire spectrum of superconductors spanned this sort of range from the original discovery up to about 23 Kelvin and had been stuck for a number of years. But all of that, of course, changed in the mid-1980s. And first of all, the discovery of the heavy fermion superconductor, uranium platinum 3, which had two peaks in the specific heat, and which I think was, most of us agree, is the first conventional, unconventional superconductor discovered, something which has a symmetry other than S-wave with anisotropy. But of course, we mostly know about the cuprates that were discovered, which took the TC enormously up by orders of magnitude. And we now know that this material has a very unconventional symmetry, and this is what I'm going to tell you about, is how the Josephson effect is important in resolving this problem. Now, of course, there are many candidates for unconventional superconductors. This plot now looks like this, and this doesn't even have some of the newer materials on it. There's a huge number of families of superconductors, most of which are unconventional. So in this blue and yellow was a picture here. here are the, now what I, is a few of the things that we believe to be unconventional. Of course, the cuprates, these are heavy fermions, organic superconductors. And two things I'll talk about later, materials in which there is an order parameter which continues varies continuously as you go around in k-space, these two materials have broken time reversal symmetry. We'll come back to those in a little bit. So if you want to try to understand what the symmetry is, and that was a challenge we had, you can take what I call this roadmap. You can write down all the possible order parameter states. These are even parity states, odd parity states. So you look at the variation of the magnitude and the phase of the order parameter. And there's a lot of things you can do, a lot of experiments you can try. You can look at the parity, you can determine whether the order parameter is real or complex. But mostly you can look at the magnitude or the phase of the order parameter. The magnitude is easily measured by many energy gaps. And almost everything gives you some, counts the number of states in the system. But it's a much harder thing to look at the phase of the order parameter. And what we actually have done is develop this technique, which we call Josephson interferometry, to measure the relative phase anisotropy. And the reason you want to do that, of course, is if you say, look, for example, at what was the current problem at the time, which was distinguishing between D-wave symmetry and some kind of S-wave symmetry, the magnitude looks pretty similar. The phase variation is very distinct. And so you want to do something which measures the phase of the function of k-space parameters. I do want to point out these two complex materials. This is D plus IS, E plus ID, P plus IP, which in this case, the order parameter becomes something other than 0 or pi. Not just a sign change, you get some continuous variation of the phase. So the experiment we did is this Josephson interferometry experiment. It's really a very simple experiment. We determine the phase anisotropy the way you always do in quantum mechanics. You make an interferometer. The Josephson effect has two important roles in this problem. First of all, so what you do is you take the crystal of interest, you put Josephson junctions on orthogonal faces, and you close it with a superconducting loop. The junctions, because of their directionality, pick out a particular k-space direction, and that's one of the roles. The other role is that by putting these in this loop, you form a DC squid, which John talked about, and by measuring the properties of this DC squid, you can measure whether there's a phase shift between orthogonal directions inside this crystal. This idea actually came to us from Tony Leggett, and relied on some very nice crystals from Don Ginsberg. So here's how this works. If you imagine taking a squid, you can actually think about a squid in analogy with a two-slit interference pattern. And so if you apply light to this, you'll get a maximum in the intensity right across from these slits. If you put something inside over one of the slits that changes the phase, like you have in the junction here, then that will shift these patterns, and you can tell that there's a phase shift. We actually prefer the single junction version of this experiment, where you wrap the junction around the corner so half of it is on one face and half on the other face. In this configuration, you get an ordinary Fraunhofer pattern when the phase shift is zero. If you actually now put something and cover half of one of the slits with some phase shift, you find the pattern goes to some distinctly different pattern. And so by this, you can back out what the phase is between different directions inside the crystal. So here's how it works for D-wave. If you start with something which is S-wave, the phase is the same on both faces. You should get an order parameter where the critical current, you should get a diffraction pattern where the critical current has a maximum of zero magnetic flux. If it's a D-wave junction, there's a pi phase shift that shifts everything, and you should have a minimum at zero magnetic flux. So here's a picture of the SWID. These are the crystals made by John Ginsberg. Here's the SWID loop, the two junctions on orthogonal faces. And we measured a lot of corner SWIDs and a lot of what we call edge SWIDs, where it's both junctions on the same face. You can see you get a distinct phase shift in these corner SWIDs, which is indicative of the D-wave order parameter. Now, one of the problems in this configuration, you see there's a bit of variation here, and that's because vortices can trap on the inside edge and cause a phase shift in this pattern. So as I said, we prefer the corner junction variation to this. And in this case, you go from a Fraunhofer pattern to this very distinct characteristic here when you have a sign change between the two directions, where you get a zero in the critical current at zero magnetic flux, and a pattern which actually has a sine x squared divided by x. Here's a picture of a single junction on a corner, and you can see this very precipitous drop in the critical current at zero magnetic field that was really direct evidence for the sign change in the D-wave symmetry. So there's a very nice variation on this. You can take a grain boundary junction. We'll hear a little bit about those a little bit later today. If you take one that we call 45-degree asymmetric, so you have a lobe pointing into the node, then small variations in the shape of this junction, the facets on the junction, will cause you to tunnel between plus and minus. It's just a corner SWID experiment with a lot of different corners. And here's actual data, and you can see that this pattern, although very complicated, is actually really simple to interpret. It's completely symmetric with respect to magnetic fields, so there's no broken symmetry, and these variations just indicate that you have a lot of multi-junction corners. And if there's any, we use this technique to test whether the order parameter was actually D-wave or had a small component of S or D leaking in. And what we found from this is the D-wave symmetry is actually extremely robust and accurate. These materials are D-wave all the time. There's nothing you can do to make them anything else. So since that, I have actually been spending most of my time looking for things with complex symmetry. And so here's such as that, and here's the two materials I want to talk about a little bit. The first is the heavy fermion superconductor uranium platinum 3. It has a TC of about half a degree. It has a second order parameter at about 0.45 degrees. And it's believed to have a transition between a real and a complex order parameter. I'm going to start by talking about the ruthenate superconductor, strontium-ruthenium oxide, TC of 1.5 degrees, fairly complicated order parameter, but in the plane, it has a very simple complex P-wave order parameter. So the way this shows up in the corner SWID experiment is if you have a phase shift other than 0 or pi, as I pointed out, it causes these this 0 to shift continuously from half a flux quantum to 0, so you can get any variation you want. And the important thing is that it breaks time reversal symmetry. You can see that by the fact that the direction in which you apply the magnetic field changes the critical current. If you apply that same technique to the corner junction, so you have a phase shift other than 0 pi, you can see the evolution from the Fraunhofer pattern to the D-wave pattern, but then you get these peaks in between that are shifted, again breaking time reversal symmetry. So here's the superconductor strontium-ruthenium oxide, which I believe is the world's most interesting superconductor. This material really has something for everybody. It's got multiple bands, it's close to a ferromagnetic transition, whereas the cuprates are close to an anti-ferromagnetic transition. It has very non-local electrodynamics, it has very interesting 3K phases, which are formed at interfaces with ruthenium. But the important thing I want to talk about is it's thought to have a very unconventional order parameter, which is the analog of the helium-3A phase, as first predicted by Morris Rice and Manfred Sievers. And in this order parameter, the energy gap is isotropic, so the magnitude is the same, but you have a phase which winds continuously as you go around in K space, and so it's a system which breaks time reversal symmetry, and because you can have Px plus Ipy and Px minus Ipy, you have the possibility of having chiral domains in the system. So when we first started to make junctions on this, here's a Josephson junction, we saw some things that we had not seen previously in either the cuprates or unconventional or other conventional superconductors. And I'll show some of these effects. There are hysteresis, there's asymmetry, there's switching noise, and all these things I think told us that something unusual was going on here. So my colors are really messed up here. Here's a picture of a hysteretic pattern. And so as you scan back and forth, you normally see these patterns retraces. I'm just plotting out here the magnetic field as a function of what's really the critical current. if you go too far, you start to get a splitting of this. And it looks very much like some kind of a magnetic hysteresis curve, and you can heal it by going back the other direction. So this told us it looked like there's some kind of pin domains that are interacting with the magnetic field. The magnetic field is actually causing some kind of domain alignment. If you go further, you can look at the diffraction pattern. You can sweep out, you can sweep up, and it looks like this is going up to a very high critical current, then it abruptly switches down to this curve. You know, the other direction goes up, switches back to this curve. So the critical current changes rather abruptly as you sweep the diffraction pattern. You can also see cases where you get telegraph noise. It's as if there's two different states here switching back and forth. And in fact, if you go through one of these hysteretic loops and come back to a different place, and you look at this as a function of time, the critical current actually will switch as this two-level telegraph noise, as if there's two different stable configurations of the critical current. So we came up with a picture in which this our idea is that this thing looks like there are chiral domains, and if you measure, if you tunnel in one direction, you pick up the sign changes from these different domains. The typical size of these is thought to be 1 micron. You can actually determine that by looking at a pattern back here, such as this, and you can count the number of wiggles before you disappear into the single junction characteristic, same way you do in an introductory quantum mechanics course to figure out how many slits you have in a diffraction grating. So by counting the number of wiggles, we come up with a number of about 1 micron as the size of these domains. Now, the appealing thing about this picture is it explains everything you see. These domains have a circulating current associated with them. It goes around the domain walls. If you move this domain wall slightly, you will change the entire pattern. So here's two configurations. If you move one domain wall, because of the interference effects, you can go from pattern A to pattern B. And with one little change in the domain wall, the critical current can switch abruptly. So small grain boundary or domain wall changes can give you large changes of switching noise that we observe. Now, this was really pinned down by looking at domains. You can look at the same junction, the same crystal, on orthogonal faces. In one direction, even though there's a domain wall, there's no sign change because the order parameter aligns in that direction, probably due to some kind of shape anisotropy. So you get a Fraunhofer pattern, and here's a picture of that. So this is the simulation. This is data. You see the critical current is about 4.5 milliamps. If you go to the other side, you can see these are out of phase now by pi. You get a pattern that looks very much like I showed you for the grain boundary junctions. And here's the data. It looks very wiggly and very reduced. Notice it's down by about 2 orders of magnitude in critical current, indicating the formation of these domain walls. Another indication of this is you can align the domains by applying a magnetic field. If you cool these in zero magnetic field, the Px plus IPy and Px minus IP domains are degenerate. When you apply a magnetic field, you can make one of them preferential. You can tend to align these. If you actually had them all aligned, this would actually be a Fraunhofer pattern. So what we're able to do is actually take this junction, cool it in a finite magnetic field, and increase the critical current, in this case, by about a factor of 3 in the sample. And this works pretty much every time. You can't go much further than this because what happens, this is a result of the experiment, that if you get too much magnetic field in here, you trap vortices, and that'll affect the pattern. But for small magnetic fields, we can show that we can align these domains, indicating the coupling of these chiral domains to the magnetic field. So one of the things we've been interested in is how big the domains are, the domain walls are. How much time do I have, John?
15 minutes.
Okay. So one of the big mysteries in this field has been how big these domains actually are, because that determines whether you might be able to see them or not by some kind of scanning squid microscopy. And so in order to do a better job of finding the size, what we did is actually made junctions. It's like a size effect. We made junctions ranging in size from 50 microns squared to about 0.5 microns squared. And the way we do this is we actually take a single junction. These are the junctions I showed you before. They're very large junctions. And we actually take this and use a focused ion beam etcher, which is a gallium beam, to cut out small junctions. Here's an example of that. It's hard to see the domain wall. I can't even see it myself. It's about in here somewhere. But when you cut this up onto this face, you form a junction, which is right here. You can actually see it better here. Sticking up above, there's the domain, the edge of the... It's actually the glue we use to stick these down. And so there's a small junction here, and we can make these of whatever size we want. And so with one junction, we can cut it into a variety of different junctions. So here's a picture of those patterns. If you start with junctions that are very small, like a half micron squared by a micron squared, you can actually form a, you can see that these form a single domain, and we see an evidence for this magnetic shifting that was just explained by Mark in the previous talk. You have a chiral domain which is generating a magnetic field. So there's a slight hysteresis in this pattern. There's another example at 1 micron. When you start to get to larger junctions, this is 2 by 2 microns, you start to see the onset of more wiggles in the diffraction pattern. So we've created a domain wall inside the junction. If we go to 4 by 4, we get a number of different domain walls. And if you just build this up, you can eventually move this right to the same size of junctions that I showed before. These junctions where you have multiple wiggles in the diffraction pattern, such as perhaps this one. So you can actually build this up, and so as a function of magnetic field, or excuse me, a function of area, we can just see the onset of these domains. So what we find interesting about this is the only system that we know of that shows these kind of chiral domains, and I think there's enormous evidence that these materials have a Px plus I Py order parameter. Okay, so last thing I want to talk about, this last few minutes here, is to talk about the heavy fermion superconductor uranium-platinum-3. Now, this is also a very unusual superconductor. If you look at the phase diagram for this, magnetic field versus temperature, it has three different phases. There's a finite magnetic field phases, but at zero magnetic field, there are two phases, which are the A phase and the B phase. So there are two distinct superconducting transitions. And the model that most people believe in, and which we have been able to verify, is that the upper phase here, which is from about 550 millikelvin to 500 millikelvin, has a real order parameter. It's a three-dimensional order parameter. There's nodes in the basal plane and the c-axis, and then these four lobes that stick up, they're sort of like D-wave nodes, and then a sign change. This is an odd symmetry material, so it changes sign with inversion symmetry. When you cross below this transition, you gap out these D-wave nodes and form a continuous order parameter in this upper region. It kind of looks like two donuts on top of each other. So you can think of this as having two distinct phases. There's a real order parameter and a complex order parameter. One turns on at the upper critical temperature, the function of the temperature. The second one turns on at the lower transition. So once you pass below here, you have a complex order parameter. If you put those all together, get an order parameter that looks like this. You start with something that looks D-wave. This is looking at a top view down on the order parameter. Sign change in orthogonal directions. As you increase the temperature, the order parameter grows, but you can also see the lifting of this node until you eventually get this isotropic order parameter, which has this form Kx plus Iky quantity squared. Okay, so here are the samples, and these are crystals made by Bill Halperin. I think I forgot to mention the last one. Those crystals, strontium-titanium oxide, are made by Yoshi Miyano in Kyoto. In this field, you are totally dependent on your crystal growers for materials. So Bill Halperin, many of you know at Northwestern, went into the business of making these crystals because they essentially shut down Los Alamos due to safety requirements. These are extremely nice single crystals. Here's a picture of one of those. They're refractory, mostly made out of niobium, or platinum, rather. And what we do is we glue it down like before and put junctions on the faces of these crystals. And here is a picture of the squid pattern. The only thing to note here of interest is to notice the voltage scale. This is in nanovolts, so we actually have to use another squid to read out the critical current in this. And I find it perhaps more amusing than important that you can actually get Shapiro steps in this with 11 kilohertz because of the voltage scale involved in this. So this shows very clearly it's a Josephson junction and has very nice characteristics. Now, the most important thing for this experiment is that if you measure the critical current as a function of temperature, you can see it turn on at this upper transition, looks pretty smooth. If you blow in on this lower region, though, you see something very interesting. There's a distinct kink in the critical current as a function of temperature. And so this is the point where you start to gap these nodes in the order parameter. That's creating more phase space to tunnel into for the critical current, and so it goes up considerably more steeply here. So this is the first experiment, other than a thermodynamics experiment, which people were able to see the two transitions that are inherent in the system. You see it as the onset of the critical current and then a change in the slope of this. So this, of course, is very exciting to us because it gives us the possibility of looking at the transition between these two order parameter phases. Okay, so let me first focus, though, on the low temperature region. So at low temperatures, the order parameter is thought to be isotropic and have this complex fit with IPY order parameter. And so one thing you see here, which is quite different than what we saw in the strontium and ruthenium oxide, is if you make a single face measurement, a single junction measurement, you don't see any evidence really for domains. There might be a little vortex trapping here. But you see what's basically a Fraunhofer-looking pattern, a few little deviations. And this peak is right at zero. And it appears to us that these don't show any evidence for hysteresis, none of the switching noise we saw before, none of the flux trapping. Whatever these order parameters are in this material, they're really deeply pinned. There's no moving around of them. Now, however, if you make a corner junction experiment, then what you find is the pattern of the type I showed before, where you get a broken symmetry. Notice there's a deviation with respect to magnetic field. It's a shifter to one side. And in all these corner junction experiments in this, what we call D phase, you find this very asymmetric pattern. Now, in fact, if you go further, you'll find that there's actually a lot of different variations you can see. This is the one I just showed you right here in the middle. This one that's shifted off from the zero. This is a simulation showing you how well it fits. Here's what you get most of the time, in fact, double peak, and we see that very often in the simulation. And we also can sometimes trap a vortex near the corner. That gives you this multiple peak pattern, and you can again simulate that. So all of these patterns are very consistent with this kx plus I ky squared pattern, indicating that this is what an order parameter, what we call an E2U form, mostly indicating this is a px plus ipy isotropic superconductor. So let me go back now to this directional tunneling. So what we're going to try to do is to, here's the what we think the order parameter must look like right when this thing starts to gap out. So we want to look at tunneling into the lobe versus tunneling into the node of this order parameter. So if you tunnel into the node of the order parameter, what you see is the critical current as a function of temperature turns on directly at this upper transition. As soon as you hit the order parameter, it starts to increase. If you move over to the lobe, or excuse me, the node, however, notice there's no spectral wave for the critical current here, and so you don't see anything until you reach the second transition, which is again right where this kink occurs in the critical current. You can see this increase and show the onset of the second transition. So here's another better, I think, picture of this. What we did is we actually made junctions in various directions. Probably the easiest seen right here. Here's the crystal glued down. Here's all these various junctions. You can look at all different angles in this. And as a function of angle, you can see the critical current is a function of temperature. So when you're around zero, this is in the lobe direction, do the critical current turn on. When you're at the node direction, you see it turn on at the lower transition. When you're in the middle, you see the kink that we saw before. You see it turn on at the upper transition, increase for a while, and then go up at a higher slope. Here it is, turning up again right here. So that's the data. This is the simulation. You can see it follows this pattern extremely well in this case. I'm almost done. So again, I think this is here's another way to look at the same data. What we did is we took a lot of different samples from two kinds of junctions. One is this one I showed before, and then we actually did a better job by actually making one junction, cutting it apart again by focused IMD matching. There's a number of different junctions along here. It's hard to see them. And you can get a finer angular resolution. I do want to point out one thing. This curve that you see here is the natural face of the crystal. This is grown by a crystal pulling machine. And so we don't do anything to the surface. And this is what gives us this nice directional tunneling provided by the Josephson effect here. And so if you plot the onset of the critical current for all of those states, you see that all of them turn on at the upper transition unless you're right at the node of the sample. And in that case, you see it turn on at the lower transition here. And if you plot those, you can see this very precipitous dip. So this is really, I think, a very interesting material as well. It is the only, actually there's two materials we know of that have two superconducting order parameters. The other is actually uranium, beryllium 13 doped with thorium. But it hasn't been, I don't know why you would make that. But, But this is the, I think it's quite unusual that of all the thousands of superconductors we know, this is the only one that we know of that shows two distinct superconducting phases with different order parameters. Now, to conclude, let me just say something about why we find these complex order parameters so interesting. I mean, first of all, it is a exotic superconducting phase, certainly nothing I think that Barney and Cooper and Schrieffer would have anticipated. It's a two-component order parameter, breaks time reversal symmetry. But even more, I think more interestingly now, this chiral complex order parameter symmetry allows for something which we call topologically protected quantum computing. John Martinez is going to talk about quantum computing, probably not this time, I don't think. But the basic idea is when you have a P-wave superconductor, you can describe this with what's called a D-vector. It describes where the spins are pointing. If you can get that to lay down the plane by applying a magnetic field, you can form some very interesting type of excitations. They're half quantum vortices that carry what are known as Majorana and fermions, something in the news a lot now. These are particles which have quasi-particles, which are their own anti-particles, and so they exhibit some very interesting non-abelian statistics. These half quantum vortices can be thought of as one spin winding and the other one being static. And the nice thing about this is it perhaps would provide a way to do quantum computing that's impervious to the types of decoherence effects that play what I've now taken to call conventional quantum computing. So there is a motivation for looking at these complex superconductors. I should say this is analogous to what has been studied a lot, the 5-half quantum Hall state. So I will stop there, and I just want to say that I think the Josen effect has another 50 years, I think, left of exciting things to do, and I certainly intend to keep working on it. So thank you, Brian. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. Any questions or comments, please? Yes, please.
Just a very basic question about geometry. In the corner junction, which surface do you measure the magnetic flux that you, when you do the magnetic field?
The magnetic flux is vertical in the corner junction. So the field, the flux we're looking at is through the loop, not through the junction.
Okay, so it's basically
external
contact
connected to that junction. Right, now in a single junction, the field, the flux lines is vertical and glides all along the edge. Screw down the flux that goes through the entire, think of it as a single junction that's just mapped around the corner of the junction. So it is the flux vertical in the same. Flux is applied in the C-axis of the crystal.
Yes, John.
It's Alan, all these cases, you just use the natural oxide, whatever grew up.
We use whatever works. The one nice thing about this, the Josen effect works for lots of different, it doesn't matter the nature of the junction. That's what's, I think, the beauty of this experiment, is it's not very model dependent on detail. As long as you get a sinusoidal or a periodic current phase relation, and has been pointed out to by many people, that occurs in SIS junctions, originally studied, occurs in SNS junctions. So in the case of the cuprates, what we do is we put copper against the surface or gold, the only things that don't damage the high TC, anneal it in and make contacts. In the case of strontium ruthenium oxide, we use a thin normal metal region. Iridium platinum 3 makes rather natural oxides itself. So whatever we can do to get a Josen effect, we can do this experiment.